MacCast, Monday, December 23rd, 2013. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is a show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, a day before Christmas Eve, so Merry Christmas to those of you who celebrate Christmas. For the rest of you, happy holidays. I hope you're having a good holiday season. I have to tell you, for me, it is crazy this time of year. I think it's crazy for me all times of year, but this time of year, even more so. You know, you just get rushing around, you got lots of things to do, lots of things on your mind, yet the world goes on and Apple and Mac news continues. So here we are, diving into the latest news and stories and also tips and tricks and hints from all of you. We've got lots of good stuff to talk about. Apple's holiday sales, how Apple is faring this holiday season. We're going to talk about the Mac Pro finally going on sale. I know a lot of people are excited about that, and some new versions of Mavericks, all those sorts of things. Also, that China Mobile deal that I kind of said was done, well, there's an update on that. It's good news, though. And then we've got feedback from you, update on the Red Mac Pro. Might not have gone to the person we thought it went to. And some people asking about some case recommendations. Also, some other stuff related to Google and Mac CPU upgrades. So lots of really cool, fun stuff to talk about in this episode. But before we get into all of that, I'd like to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that's Drobo. For those of you who don't know what a Drobo is, well, Drobo is a hardware product. It's actually a smart storage product, really a family of storage products that are arrays. Think of RAID, but it's really a lot more than that. The Drobo is meant to be kind of like this appliance. It's very simple to set up and use. It's completely expandable, and like a RAID product, it can protect you against hard drive failures and crashes and things like that. Basically, Drobos come with different configurations. 4 and 5 drive model options are available, and they have a whole host of choices of interfaces. So they have Thunderbolt USB 3 versions and also network attached versions with gigabit Ethernet. So really, depending upon the kind of workflow that you have, there likely is a Drobo that's going to meet your needs. The Drobo 5D, that's the Drobo that I have, is designed for speed. It's a direct connected Drobo. It has a multi-core CPU, Thunderbolt or USB 3 for connectivity, and takes 5 3.5-inch SATA hard drives. So you load it up with drives, and then the Drobo software that you install will take care of configuring it, managing it, and setting it up so that you have redundancy protection. And the Drobo will alert you. It's got these lights on the front that will alert you if there's a problem with one of your drives. And this actually happened to me with my original FireWire 4-bay Drobo, the one that's hooked up to my Mac Mini that I use for some archival storage. And it was really nice because I knew I didn't have to panic. I knew the Drobo had backed up and protected my data. Okay, I had a failed drive. I have to deal with that. But all I had to do was run out, get a new drive, and I was actually able to get a larger drive. So I expanded my storage at the same time, came home, popped out the bad drive, popped the new one in, and that drive was actually under warranty. So I got to send that back in and get a new drive that I could put back in another Drobo. So it took what normally would be a really bad experience, say if I just had a single hard drive connected to my Mac, and made it really a non-issue. And that's really what you want, and that's the kind of advantages that a Drobo can give you. So you have your direct connected Drobo, like the Drobo 5D. There's also a Drobo Mini, so that's designed for portability. It's 7 inches by 2 inches by 7 inches, basically. A little bit larger than that, weighs just 3 pounds. And again, it has a multi-core GPU, so it's fast. It's got Thunderbolt and USB 3 connectivity. And that one takes up to 4 2.5-inch hard drives. So you can take that on the road with you. So if you're a photographer, you're a video person, someone who works in the field, and you want to have that kind of protection along with you, you can take that. And then there's also a Drobo 5N, which is your network detached version. It has gigabit Ethernet. That one has a quad-core CPU, so it was really built with high-performance media editing in mind. And they just announced that this week, as a matter of fact, that there are now Drobo apps that you can get for your Drobo 5N. Really cool stuff. Go to drobo.com/drobo-apps if you want to see everything they have. I think they launched with 15 different applications, but some really cool ones are a Plex app. So it has a Plex server in there. You can load it up with all your media, your movies, your TV shows, and then stream that to your television, your Mac, or iOS device, anything with a Plex client directly from your Drobo. They have Elephant Drive, which allows you to do secure automated cloud backup. And there's a whole bunch of community apps, including CrashPlan. You know, I'm a big fan of CrashPlan, so I'm going to be definitely looking into that one. There's a BitTorrent client called Transmission, one of the better ones out there on the market. And then I'm a web developer, so I'm really excited. They have a full Apache LAMP, LAMP stack, including Apache PHP Server and MySQL. So that's going to make the Drobo 5N even more amazing. And then on top of that, all of the Drobos have this technology where you can add in an mSATA SSD card, and that will accelerate the caching on your Drobo. So it's really designed for applications where you have a lot of small files that you need access to. It's really going to speed the Drobo up. So things like image libraries, it's perfect for iPhoto, Aperture, Lightroom. Drobos have been very popular among digital photographers, and I was playing around with mine. I have the mSATA option with my iPhoto library and moved it over there, and immediately things were just popping up as I was scrolling through my library. I wasn't waiting for those thumbnails and images to show up. As a matter of fact, Drobo says the caching can make specific applications open up and react up to 12 times faster. I don't know about that, but I just know it seems blazingly fast. And best of all, because you're a MacCast listener, you can get 10% off the Drobo of your choice right now. So go to drobostore.com, pick out the Drobo that you want, configure it up. You can get it with or without drives. Although if you load in drives, you'll notice as you're configuring it, they have a really great pricing on drives. A 5D without a drive is $699 US, but you can add in 10 gigabytes of storage, 5 2-gigabyte drives, and it brings the price up just to $11.99. So they are not gouging you for those drives, really just right around current market prices. Plus, if you use the code MC10, like MacCast10, during checkout, you'll get 10% off that price. So you can save even more, get a better deal. So go to drobostore.com to take advantage of that, drobo.com to get all the information and details on the products, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. Well, it turns out that Apple updating their iPhone line recently has turned out to be a good thing for their market share, at least in the U.S. and among U.S. carriers. Since Apple updated the lineup, they have remained the top-selling device at all the big four U.S. carrier stores. This is according to Canaccord Genuity, who has been keeping track over the past 3 months. Apple has mostly held the number one and number three positions at AT&T, Verizon, Sprint, and T-Mobile stores, with the 5S on top and the 5C, usually coming in third. The Samsung Galaxy S4 held the second place spot, except for in September at AT&T and Sprint stores, where the iPhone 5C had a brief time in the number two position. Outside the U.S., Canaccord also notes that the iPhone is doing well in specific markets. In Japan, for example, it's leading smartphone sales, and in the last month, the iPhone tripled its market share in China, jumping from 4% in September to almost 13% in October, according to the market research firm Counterpoint. Now, I don't find these numbers particularly surprising because Apple did just update the lineup and a lot of people had been waiting for new devices to come out. And anytime a new smartphone product comes out, you're going to see numbers jump up. But something that is surprising is that at least one analyst thinks that the steady climb up may continue for a while. A Simco analyst, Horace Dedu, thinks that Apple's iPhone could have up to a 68% share of the U.S. market by 2014. And he's basing this on some historical growth rates that he's been monitoring since October 2009 through October 2013. And what he noticed was that the market share growth rates of Apple's products compared to competitive products are more closely matching the overall growth rate of the smartphone industry as a whole. So rather than sort of dropping off over time, Apple is staying in line with that growth rate. And he's assuming if that trend continues, then Apple could wind up with a larger percentage of the U.S. market share by 2014. Now, Do I buy it? I'm not really sure, because we're talking about a very volatile market and almost anything can happen, especially if a new disruptive product comes on board before 2017. I mean, we're talking a few years out, so that totally could change. But just looking at the growth rates and numbers right now, that's how he's drawing that conclusion. And it doesn't look to be just the iPhone that's going to score big this holiday season. The iPad is also looking to be a big winner, at least among holiday tablet shoppers. ChangeWave did their latest poll, and they asked holiday buyers which tablet they would be considering buying this holiday season, and 72%, according to their report, said it would be an iPad. And that number is up 17% from the last time they conducted this survey back in August. In terms of which iPads those consumers are looking to buy, 55% said it would be an iPad Air, 16% said it would be a mini with a Retina display, 5% said a non-Retina mini, and most surprisingly to me was that 7% said it would be an iPad 2. So I guess that iPad 2 pricing is drawing in a certain percentage of customers, 7% to be exact. Another 17% said they really weren't sure, probably trying to still figure out which model they were going to go for. I don't know how they're going to make that buying decision, because we're almost through the holiday season. They've just got a few days or a few hours left probably at this point. But then there was another 1% who were buying some other model of iPad. I'm assuming, I don't know what you'd buy, maybe a used iPad 1, something like that, maybe on eBay. But that's how everything broke out according to those latest ChangeWave numbers. And despite some of the backlash that it got over its visual look, iOS 7 looks to be installed on more U.S. Apple devices than any other version of iOS. This is according to the web analytics firm Chitika, who's been keeping track of the adoption rate of iOS 7 since it was launched. Their latest checks show that iOS 7 is on almost 70% of all U.S. iOS devices, and that people seem to prefer it on their iPhones a little bit more than their iPads. According to their numbers, 74.1% of iPhones seem to be running iOS 7, while iPads running iOS 7 are at just 63.8%, but still pretty large numbers on both devices. And one of the theories as to why iOS is not being adopted as quickly on iPads is that with older iPads still in the marketplace, as a matter of fact, Apple's still selling the iPad 2, those devices don't get some of the bells and whistles that you would if you were using a newer iPad by running the newer operating system. So things like AirDrop, for example, and according to some of the reports that I read, those are the sorts of features that maybe incentivize people to upgrade, and if you don't get those advantages, maybe you just stick with the OS that you already have. I'm not really sure that I buy that. I think most people, if they're capable of running the latest and greatest operating system, they generally upgrade. That's been my experience, but for sure the numbers are indicating that something is going on. My theory is that there are still a lot of iPad 1s out there on the market, and those devices just simply can't be updated to iOS 7. And let's not forget about the Mac. The Mac also seems to be doing particularly well this holiday season. This is according to the latest numbers from NPD Group. They say that Mac sales are up 29% so far this holiday season, though they do note that the number, which marks growth compared to the same period last year, might be a bit misleading. If you remember last year, Apple had new iMacs out, but they came very late in the holiday quarter, and the supplies were incredibly constrained, so there just weren't a whole lot to go around. As a matter of fact, later in a financial conference call, Tim Cook even admitted that it would have been better if Apple had waited to launch the iMac in 2013, when supplies would have been a bit better and they could have had more in the retail channel. Still, it's good news for Mac sales this season, and Piper Jaffray analyst Gene Munster thinks the Mac will see an overall growth of 13% year-over-year for the December quarter. And one thing you would think could have helped Apple's Mac sales this holiday season would have been the release of a Mac Pro, but it's coming way too late in the quarter, I think, for that to happen, although it is now here. We know that the Mac Pros are being manufactured in the USA, as a matter of fact, in Austin, Texas. We know that because Tim Cook actually tweeted a picture of them on the assembly line last week or a couple weeks ago. So we have seen them being produced. They are being made, but they are in really short supply. As a matter of fact, Apple finally started taking orders for the new Mac Pro last Thursday, and it became really clear that the supply was not going to be even close to meeting demand. The Mac Pro showed up on Apple's website on the 19th and was available for sale, but was not showing ship dates until December 30th in the U.S. and January everywhere else. The U.S. store also was offering an in-store pickup option, but again, you would not be able to go into a retail store and pick up your new Mac Pro until the end of December at the earliest. Also, very quickly, within hours as a matter of fact, the ship times dropped to February, with some reports saying that orders were not due to arrive until March. So if you don't have your order in now, you are likely going to be waiting at least until February or March, possibly longer. The good news is we now have more details on pricing and configurations. We had some limited information before, but now we know that a base model 3.7 gigahertz quad-core version with 256 gigabytes of flash storage and 12 gigabytes of RAM is going to set you back $2,999 US. The next step up in base configurations from there is the 6-core 3.5 gigahertz model with 256 gigabytes of flash storage and 16 gigabytes of RAM. That jumps the price $1,000 to $3,999 US. From there, you can config to order like crazy. There are a bunch of options, but if you go in and max out the entire system, you can wind up with a 2.7 gigahertz 12 core model with 1 terabyte of flash storage and 64 gigabytes of RAM. That's going to set you back close to 10 grand at $9,599 US. And before you say that that top of the line model pricing is ridiculous, let me remind you that way back in 1992, Apple released the Macintosh 2FX. That was a 1-core 40 megahertz processor, 40 megabytes of storage, and no built-in RAM. Yep, didn't come with RAM. It had 8 slots, and you could max it out at 128 megabytes. But the base model without the RAM, 40 gigahertz processor, and a 40 megabyte hard drive, that was base priced at about $10,000 US. So more than that shiny new Mac Pro system, and I argue not nearly as capable, although for the time it was a pretty impressive machine. I was in a lab, I had a computer lab at my college that had just received those when I started my freshman year, and that was an amazing lab to work in. It was for the graphic communications department at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, and we were happy to have those machines. Of course, they were loaded up with all kinds of expansion cards and things like that. That was the big feature of the 2FX. That is very different than the Mac Pro, where all of your expansion is going to have to happen externally. And even though you might not be getting that shiny new Mac Pro until later next year, don't worry, Apple already has a firmware update out and ready for you. That would be for the machine that you don't quite have yet, but you can download it now and have it ready and waiting in your downloads folder. Just go to apple.com/support and you'll find the Mac Pro EFI firmware update 2.0 for the Mac Pro. It improves system reliability during the reboot process, also resolves an issue related to the memory self-test, and will improve the graphics power management when using boot camp. Once you do get that new Mac Pro, though, you are certainly not going to be disappointed, at least according to some of the reports we've been seeing. Actually, Apple got the Mac Pro out into the hands of reviewers, so it's been out in the wild, and so far the reports have been amazingly positive and also touting how impressively fast the new machine is. One site, fcp.co, posted actually a 24-hour hands-on review, and Macworld also had some really nice things to say about the new Mac Pro. The flash drive performance is smoking. Write speeds are said to be in the range of 252.8 megabits per second to 985.5 megabits per second, with read speeds coming in at over 800 megabits per second to 920.5 megabits per second. So you can shuffle your data around super fast on that new model. FCP.co also reported that the video performance is amazing. They were able to get 16 simultaneous streams of 4K video playing without a hitch. They also tried to bump things up and see if they could actually get it to drop frames in Final Cut Pro. They took a red raw 4K clip and then progressively applied real-time video effects and filters to it in an attempt to get it to break, and they were able to reach 18 real-time effects before they just literally gave up because they had to get the review out. And they were not throwing wimpy effects and filters at it. They were throwing things like Gaussian blur and beach bypass, and it trucked along without blinking. They actually posted a video on their website, and they were laughing giddily as they saw just how the Mac Pro, the new Mac Pro, was just chewing up the video. So you are not going to be disappointed with that Pro performance, I don't think, in any way, shape, or form. Macworld's 8-core Mac Pro got a single-core Geekbench score of 3,599 and a multi-core score of 25,997. So that was just above some of the leaked Geekbench scores we had been seeing before the release of the new Mac Pro. And a lot of the reviews I've been reading say the thermal core cooling system is very, very quiet. It does keep the heat down and creates a sort of nice thermal updraft just above the front of the unit. If you haven't looked at it, the way the Mac Pro handles cooling is it just has a single fan. It sort of draws air in the bottom of the device and then channels it up through the thermal core, sort of this triangular shaped channel in the middle of that cylinder, and then pushes it out the top. So there's a nice little bit of heat coming off of it. As a matter of fact, I immediately thought on reading that it'd be really cool if someone made a little toy hang glider that could maybe float around in that little air current above your Mac Pro. And if you're worried about overheating, one report I read said that if you do block the top vents, say by placing a book on top of the Mac Pro, something like that, the system will shut down before it ends up overheating. But you definitely don't want to block that current of airflow, because that is the only fan and the only cooling system that the Mac Pro has. But that's good because it actually keeps noise down, which is going to be great for Pro production environments. And then to go along with that new Mac Pro, Apple also did update and optimize many of its Pro applications. Final Cut Pro 10.1 came out with a bunch of optimizations and performance enhancements. It does things like tweak the software to better support the new dual GPU configuration, also adds support for 4K video monitoring, which is another big feature in the Mac Pro. You can drive a lot of 4K displays. Apple's not actually selling their own 4K display. I'm not sure why we haven't seen an updated display from Apple yet. Hopefully that is something that is coming, but when you go to order your new Mac Pro, they are offering up sharp 4K displays as an add-on option. And I personally don't have a need for the screaming raw performance nor the price tag of a new Mac Pro, so I won't be getting one. But if any of you do get one, I'd love to hear some thoughts and impressions and reviews from the Mac community. I know some of you have emailed me to let me know that you have yours on order. It might be a while before you can actually give us a hands-on review, but I look forward to getting those. And so when you do have an opportunity, first impressions are great. Also, maybe some more hardcore testing. Those of you who are working in high-end applications like 3D and games and video, love to hear from you. And when that does happen, send your comments, responses, and thoughts to maccast@gmail.com. If you're running OS X Mavericks, there was an update pushed out last week. Apple released OS X update 10.9.1, and a lot of the updates look to be focused on improvements to Mail. The update brings, according to Apple, improved support for Gmail in OS X Mail and fixes for users with custom Gmail settings. Also, improved reliability of smart mailboxes and search inside Mail. The update resolves an issue that prevented VoiceOver from speaking sentences that contained emoji. And the update contains an improvement for Safari. It will now update shared links periodically when the feature is open in the Safari sidebar. If you haven't picked up the update yet, you can get it through Apple's software update in the Mac App Store. Also, you can check Apple's website at apple.com/support. And literally just days after Apple released the 10.9.1 update, they also released a new version to developers, macOS 10.9.2. The big news out of that update is that it's going to bring FaceTime audio support to the Mac desktop. That was something that was added in iOS 7, so you'll now be able to make FaceTime audio calls from your iOS device and your Macs, at least when 10.9.2 finally gets released. And as far as other features, Apple is asking developers to pay attention to Mail, Messages, also virtual private network features, as well as the graphic drivers, and to VoiceOver. So we can expect improvements and updates to at least those parts of the operating system. It's hard to get a lot of details about future OS updates because Apple has the developers under NDA, so we don't get a lot of specific details, but there's usually some release notes that come out that kind of indicate what Apple's working on. And we're nearing the close of 2013, about to move into 2014. And so you know what that means. It's already time to start ramping up the 2014 Apple rumors. As a matter of fact, we have a front runner when it comes to the latest round of rumors. And it actually started months ago. So got a little early jump on 2014. And that's the new larger iPad. Boy Genius Reports notes that this one has already been seen from many reliable sources, including the Wall Street Journal. The general belief is that Apple has been working on and testing a 12.9-inch iPad, and that it could potentially be called the iPad Pro. The latest source to leak details is the International Business Times, and they say, among other things, that their sources have confirmed that iPad Pro name. The site also says that Apple will release two versions of a 12.9-inch iPad in 2014. The first, they say, will come this April and will have a quad HD 2K display, but that will be followed later in the year in October by an Ultra HD 4K display. The DigiTimes, not to be left out, then weighed in. They say the 12.9-inch model will be out in October and that Apple is considering it as a replacement for the 11-inch MacBook Air, and also that it will be targeted at education. So they have disputed the April timeframe, and they didn't, I don't think, in their report mention anything about a 4K version of the iPad. Other rumor sites are also lining up other new products for Apple's 2014 event already. Some say that the iWatch or some sort of wearable or fitness product will be out from Apple in October. We're also hearing all those reports of new iPhone models. Basically, almost everyone's saying that we can expect a larger display. How large is really what's been in dispute for a while now. Anything from 4.7 inches to 5.7 inches, according to various sources. And in the same DigiTimes piece where they said that the 12.9-inch iPad Pro would be coming out, they say Apple will have a larger iPhone using TSMC's 20-nanometer processors, but that it will be out this spring in May. So I find it interesting that we're hearing May and October dates for both potential new iPhones and potential new iPads. There seems to be some confusion or some disagreement on exactly which products we will get when, but we could see something happening in May. And the other rumor that's still floating around out there is that Apple's going to do some sort of Apple television set, although details on that one seem to be a little bit more obscure and a little bit more fuzzy, I think, personally, because I don't think Apple's ever going to make a TV set. I think that's just an R&D project, something they're playing around with. I don't see that happening, at least not this year. I think Apple's going to stick with the Apple TV set-top box form factor and continue to expand and improve that throughout this year. And if you're wondering about those bigger devices and you like reading in things to comments made by Tim Cook, Tim Cook wrote an end-of-the-year email to employees reflecting on 2013 and all the achievements and successes that Apple had this year, and then mentioned that Apple has, quote, some big plans that we think customers are going to love, end quote, for 2014. So a lot of sites reading in the word big in there was not just mentioned as a passing concept, that it actually alludes or indicates that Apple is working on bigger devices and products. I don't get caught up in that sort of thing. I don't think that's what was going on. I think he literally just means that Apple has a lot of great announcements for 2014. And that's a typical statement that Tim Cook will make running year from year. So I'm not reading that stuff into it. But if you want to do that sort of thing, by all means. And actually, some rumor sites are already getting a jump on 2015, believe it or not. DigiTimes is right in there. They're one of our favorite sources for Apple rumors, and they are a mixed bag, often right, often not so right. But apparently, they say they can predict the future and are saying that Apple is already signing up Samsung and Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing, TSMC, to produce their A9 series mobile processors for some time in 2014. The chips reportedly will be based on a new 14-nanometer process node, and Samsung will produce about 30 to 40% of the processors for Apple's supply needs, with TSMC filling in production for the rest. I do find it interesting that Apple is already locking up suppliers and contracts for 2015. That's actually a good thing if they're doing it, because they can lock in pricing and agreements and stuff like that, don't have to deal with a lot of details and have everything lined up for well into the future. I think that's something Apple actually has been doing for a while, so I don't find it too surprising we're hearing these rumors. As a matter of fact, both those companies had already locked up with Apple production for the A8 series happening this year, sometime this year, and that reportedly is going to be using their 20-nanometer technologies. Remember on the last show when I told you that the deal with Apple and China Mobile was finally done, that it was happening, it was a sure thing, there was going to be an announcement, it was going to be happening this past week? Well, guess what? It turned out not a sure thing, turned out to not always be a sure thing. As a matter of fact, even after it turned out to not be a sure thing, it was looking like a deal with Apple and China Mobile was going to be iffy, but now it is official. It is a done deal. What happened was, I was reading reports a couple weeks ago that the deal was done. That turned out not to be the case. What was happening was, December 18th was supposed to be the day that the Chinese government was going to announce their new 4G service beginning. China Mobile said that they were going to be doing a big announcement of a new brand, and the Wall Street Journal had said that China Mobile was going to have the iPhone on December 18th. So all those things were lining up to make us believe that that was what was going to happen. Well, it didn't happen. And this deal, why it's such a big deal and everybody's talking about it, is because China Mobile has over 700 million subscribers. So if Apple can get the iPhone on China Mobile officially, and if they can just get a 10%, even just 10% of China Mobile customers with iPhones, that means 70 million new iPhone owners, and that is a big deal for Apple. Even if they get a smaller percentage of that, that's a nice bump up in Apple's numbers. As a matter of fact, some estimates say that there are already 42 million iPhones on China Mobile, and that's without any kind of partnership or official deal being in place. So it is going to be a big thing for Apple. KGI analyst Ming-Chi Kuo isn't quite as positive on those numbers or on how many new iDevices China Mobile customers might buy. And he also thought that the iPhone 5C, the slow or weak sales of the iPhone 5C, might be the thing that was slowing up the deal. He said, quote, "We believe that weak sales of the iPhone 5C may trigger a renegotiation of Apple and China, of the Apple and China Mobile partnership," end quote. Kuo's thinking is that the deal would bring about 15 to 20 million iPhone unit shipments in 2014 and another 20 to 30 million by 2015. So you're looking at their 35 million to 50 million new iPhone customers on China Mobile. That's a little bit more conservative than some of the other numbers that are being thrown around. But what happened earlier this week is, it looks like we now have official confirmation. China Mobile announced on Sunday in the U.S., probably Monday morning for China, if I'm doing my international dateline and time zone thing right, which I'm probably not. But regardless, the iPhone on China Mobile is official. They're getting both the 5S and the 5C, and they're going to be on that new 4G network that the government did announce back on the 18th. So all is good, and now we can stop talking about that rumor and actually see how the numbers pan out. I think one of the more recent numbers I heard was that an analyst expects Apple to gain another 17 million iPhone customers with the China Mobile deal in 2014, with more coming on board in 2015. If you've ever been the type of person who worries about those cameras on your devices spying on you without your knowledge, your paranoia went up a couple notches this week. Two researchers at Johns Hopkins University published a paper describing how they were able to remotely control a Mac's EyeSight camera, but do so without triggering the little green light to come on, indicating that it would be turned on and watching. The security community and Mac blogs promptly blew up the story and went crazy about how we were all going to be the targets of video cyber spying without our knowledge, and that this was horrible and awful and things like that. But the paper notes that the Mac and OS X are specifically designed not to allow the camera to be active without the light being lit. The trick was that the researchers found a workaround by compiling and writing their spying application to actually run on the camera's CPU, bypassing the Mac's hardware and software controls. So normally, your software would be running off of your Mac's CPU, but in this case, because so many of the components inside your Mac have their own CPUs, they were able to compile and write the software to run on that, thereby bypassing some of those security controls. It's actually a brilliant hack, but a lot of the reports, not the paper, but a lot of the reports left some of the specific details out of their story, and these are details that might help you sleep a little bit easier at night. The biggest one was that the hack was accomplished on 2008 and older Macs only, so newer Mac models don't seem to be prone to this specific hack. That's not to say that a similar technique could not be developed or used to exploit the hardware in newer Macs, but that hasn't been done yet. The researchers published the source code for a fix also, so that if you are worried about your older Mac, you can get that. And they also have shared their research with Apple and have been in contact with them, although it's unclear if Apple will ever really issue a patch for older model Macs that are out there to kind of close up this exploit. The other thing is that to get this exploit to work, you are going to have to install a malicious program on your Mac, so that would either have to happen by you opening up some sort of Trojan or installing some sort of software that has been compromised with the hack, or someone would actually have to have physical access to your device to be able to get in there and install and configure and set things up. So that's very likely not to happen. I guess they could also potentially install it remotely if they had somehow installed remote control software onto your system without your knowledge. But the point is that it's going to be very hard for you to get targeted by this Mac. You have to have an older Mac. You have to get some, you know, there's just too many things going on in there to have this be much of a thing to worry about. Also, you have things like Gatekeeper that are in the newer versions of the operating system that would likely alert you if something was trying to be installed on your system, especially a non-signed software application, unless you've turned that feature of Gatekeeper off. So if you're really, really worried about all of this, the simplest fix is put a post-it note over your EyeSight camera lens, and then that completely solves the issue. If it comes on, all they're going to see is a giant yellow blur. So while the hack is a little bit creepy, it is pretty easily thwarted by a physical reverse hack, I guess, as it were. And I totally get that this kind of thing just opens up all kinds of thoughts about maybe things that the government or agencies are doing to spy on all of us, but there's a lot of other mechanisms that also enable this kind of monitoring and tracking and stuff like that. So if you're really worried about this kind of stuff, your best solution is to just not use computers and devices and technology at all, not go on the internet, and basically not live your life. That's not a world that me being a tech geek, I'm willing to move into. So I guess we're just going to have to keep our awareness up. You know, like we've always talked about on this show, this is about keeping up your awareness and sort of making your own choices about where you want to control your security and privacy versus the amount of convenience and the kinds of technology that you want to use. And with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile. You know I am a huge fan of Smile software. They make great applications for your Mac, for your iOS devices. I know you are all fans of Smile as well, especially listening to this podcast, and you have a lot of Smile software. But you know what? It's the holidays, so the holidays is really about giving. And chances are that you or someone you love is probably getting a shiny new iThing for Christmas. So why not help them be more productive right out of the gate by gifting them a Smile application? For example, PDF Pen Scan Plus, that would be perfect for giving to someone so that they can scan OCR and archive their documents, maybe all those receipts from their holiday purchases, give them a jump up on getting organized for the new year. And it's really easy to gift an application on the iTunes App Store. You just go in there, you find the application you want to gift, so PDF Pen Scan Plus, PDF Pen for iPhone or iPad, maybe Text Expander Touch. You find the application, and then right next to the Buy button, or if you've already purchased the app, it'll be a Download button, there's a little drop-down. You click on that, and you'll notice right there at the top it says Gift This App. You plug in the email address for the person you want to gift the application to, and it's really cool. You can even delay the sending, so you can have it show up Christmas morning, just like your Santa Claus. So pick the application you'd think they'd like, or better yet, just give them the whole bundle. Buy them all. I mean, they're totally affordable, so it's not going to cost you a whole lot, and you're going to make someone very, very happy and more productive on their new iOS device. And if you don't have all of the Smile applications yourself, why not slip in a copy or two for yourself? Why not? And Smile also makes really great Mac software, so if you want to check that stuff out along with their great iOS applications, you can just head over to their website, smilesoftware.com. You can get all the information and details there. And a big thank you to Smile for their support of the MacCast. Kicking things off here, I have a small update to a story I told you about on the last episode of the MacCast. Actually, a little correction. Despite the fact that there were pictures of him showing up with two of the most expensive Mac products ever produced, photos that showed up on Twitter, Tony Fadell made a statement also on Twitter that he is not the owner of the red Mac Pro or the gold Apple EarPods that were in that charity auction done by Sotheby's and Jonathan Ive and Mark Newsom. Well, I guess they were actually Johnny Ive and Mark Newsom products developed for the Sotheby's auction to raise money for the Red Charity, which fights AIDS. The two items actually sold for a combined $1.4 million, so had Fadell actually bought the products, it was a nice little chunk of change to get those things, but apparently he was just looking at them for the actual, or with the actual owner, the person who actually purchased the products. He did not buy them himself, and he said that if that owner wants to come forward and reveal themselves, they can, but he wasn't going to do it. So we still don't know who bought those items, but still, very nice donation, basically, to a really great charity, $1.4 million. Plus, they got some really cool products. If you haven't seen those, go search for the photos online. There was actually a whole lineup of really cool products that were developed for that auction, and really, really neat stuff if you haven't seen it. So that story with the EyeSight camera being hacked on those older Macs, that actually prompted just some discussion. And I think this is always good when this stuff happens. It prompts discussion of just security and privacy concerns and stuff like that. And so you start to see reports and articles and things related to security and just tips and tricks for kind of better protecting your privacy and your security. And I saw a couple good ones this week, and I wanted to point out a few and just make some comments. These are just like simple little things that you can do to have better protection with your Macs and your devices. And a lot of them seem obvious at first, but there are also a lot of things that a lot of us don't do. So I think these are just serve as like good reminders of kind of the best practices, the minimal best practices that we should be taking to sort of protect our security and privacy. And number one is put a password on everything, and a good secure password, not, you know, your dog's name or your pet's name. Like, pick a good secure password. Use something like 1Password to actually generate something, or work out some sort of way to remember a good secure password. And length is the key here. Well, length and the fact that it's not common words that would normally be found together. You can pick sort of nonsense words, actual words, and combine them together, but the longer the better. So I'm currently trying to make my passwords be at least 24 to 32 characters long. And I know that seems ridiculous, but that's really what you want to do to have good protected privacy. And, you know, even doing simple things like putting a passcode lock on your phone. I know so many people that don't have passcode locks on their iPads or their iPhones. Use the simple passcode lock. That's better than nothing. Be better if you can use a complex one, a longer one, 24 to 32 characters, or, you know, if that's too hard, set a long, complex password and then use Touch ID. Anything to better protect your devices. And also make sure that you have your devices set to auto lock and that time delay is short. The shorter, the better. If you got it set to auto lock, but it's not locking for several hours, that still opens up the opportunity, if your device is lost or stolen, for someone to get in there and get at a lot of your personal data. I think I have mine set to 5 minutes or less on both my Mac and my iOS devices. It's a little bit less convenient, but a lot more secure, and the hassle, the little bit of hassle that you have, is minimal compared to the amount of extra security you get by just simply turning that on. Another common thing, the tip that I read was, you know, sign out of your social media and your email accounts when you finish using them in your browser. So if you've been on Twitter or Facebook, make sure that you sign out when you walk away, even on your own computer. I would say expand that. Actually, any accounts or websites that you're worried about someone getting into, you should click the logout button. So many of us, and I'm guilty of this all the time, you go in, you log into your account, it sets a session thing, you remain logged in. You, how about checking that little box that says, keep me logged in? Keeping that unchecked and just logging in every time adds an additional layer of security and protection for you. And logging out also does that. Another thing I would say is don't let Keychain save your passwords. Enter them in. Anytime you can require the password entry, that's going to give you better protection. And for sure, do not let the browser save your passwords. We've seen too many reports of browsers having security holes. It's just another company, another entity that you're sort of trusting with your password credentials and things like that. The OS X keychain is one thing, or the iCloud keychain now, but it's a whole other thing to let, you know, Chrome or Firefox or even Safari be sort of the keeper of that secure information. I generally just don't trust those things. I'd rather have it in something I know is secure, like a 1Password system or the OS keychain. And if you're going to use the OS keychain, you know, you don't have to use it. You don't have to save that stuff in there. I generally don't let Keychain save a lot of my web credentials. I leave that stuff out so that I have to force myself to enter it in, and it adds that extra layer of security. But if you are going to store that stuff in your iCloud Keychain, then you better make sure that you have a really good secure password locking your Mac, because once they have access to that, the Keychain is wide open and they would have access to everything else. So make sure that you're doing that. For web-based services that offer it, if they offer a multi-step authentication process, a two-factor authentication, opt in for that. Do that. Yes, two-factor can be a little bit more of a hassle, but it affords a lot better protection and a lot more security for your account just getting randomly hacked, because it relies on having two things, having something physical that you have access to, like your iPhone in most cases. So usually they'll send you a text message and you have to put in a code that's sent to your physical device so that they know you have that device. And that combined with something you know, which would be the password that you have for that account. And again, good, strong, secure passwords generated by something like 1Password or LastPass or KeePass or whatever system you use, that's always a good thing. Another thing on the browsing side, make sure that you're going in there and you're clearing out your browser history and occasionally clearing out your cookies and stuff like that. There's a lot of stuff that builds up in there, a lot of personal data and information that can build up in your cookies and your browser history, and you don't want someone gaining access to that. So I try and clear that stuff periodically, and if you're really worried about it, use private mode or incognito mode if you're a Chrome user, and that way it's not going to store cookies and tracking data and information and stuff like that. And then finally, yes, if you're really worried about that web camera, the webcam spying on you, just put a sticker over it, put a little sticky over it, and that's going to block out that issue. I'm sure there's some other really cool, simple tips and tricks that you have for maintaining security and privacy. If you want to share some of those with us, shoot me an email or a quick audio comment, mattcast@gmail.com. I received a really nice voicemail this week from Scott, and unfortunately the audio came through a little bit rough on the voicemail line, so I'm not going to be able to play it for you, but basically Scott was telling me he recently replaced his 32GB iPad 2 with a new 64GB iPad Air. So congratulations on that, Scott. I love my iPad Air. And he did it during Apple's Black Friday deals event, and that was cool because he had a really great experience, one, ordering the iPad Air through Apple's App Store app and using the in-store pickup feature. If you have never used that and you have the ability to purchase and pick up in an Apple retail store, I suggest using it. It is a great example of a really nice retail experience because you do everything digitally. You walk in there with your phone. Now with the whole iBeacons thing, when you walk in the store, if you have the app enabled, it can pop up with your order information right when you walk in the store, so you have the order number ready. You walk over to the personal pickup person. They just go back. They already have the product ready and waiting with a little sticker on it. It's got your name on it. They hand it off to you, and pretty much you sign just to show that you picked it up, and you walk out of the store. It is a great way to purchase stuff, especially for someone like me who's not a big fan of the whole retail experience. I don't like going out to retail stores. I'm totally an Amazon Prime person now, and Apple has made a lot of the pain points of retail buying go away. But Scott went through that experience, had that same great experience I just described. But the cool thing was, because he bought on Black Friday, it was a Black Friday deal, Apple was giving out, in this case, a $75 Apple Store gift card. And when he ordered online, he received that gift card email even before he went in to pick up his product. So he had the $75 ready to go when he was in there picking up his new MacBook, his new iPad Air, excuse me. And so he opted when he was in there to pick up the iPad Air smart case, which he had the smart case for the iPad 2, really liked it. Unfortunately, though, he was extremely unhappy with the iPad Air version of the case. Happy with the iPad itself, the increase in size, speed, storage, great screen, not so happy with the case. And the biggest issue, I guess, Scott, you said, was the threefold cover design versus the fourfold. So if anybody had the smart case or smart cover for an iPad 2, you know it has these four little folds, and you can fold it up and turn it into a stand for watching movies and things like that. You can also flip it over and kind of use it to prop up for typing on the keyboard in landscape mode. I personally have not had any issues with my smart cover. I didn't go with the smart case. The difference between, for those of you who don't know, between the case and the cover is the case goes all the way around the back and then has a smart cover that folds over the top, whereas the smart cover is just the thing that attaches with the little the magnets that are built into the iPad. I have not had any issues with the threefold design, at least on my iPad Air, with the smart cover. I have kind of had issues and not been a big fan of the iPad mini case. And I think, Scott, this is probably what you were having trouble with, is that when you have the threefold design, it doesn't kind of fold back on itself, so it feels a little bit less stable, like it's not going to stay together. And I had that problem with my iPad mini case, but I haven't experienced that with the iPad Air case. Now, I don't know if there's some differences between the smart cover and the smart case, and maybe that is the issue. Also, I mostly use my iPad Air in the stand mode, not the typing mode, and I think the typing mode's a little bit more of a problem, especially if you press down hard on the screen. The threefold design can kind of fold up and fall down. Sounds like you're using it both ways, Scott. So what Scott was asking me, though, is do I have any case recommendations or alternatives that are going to be more like the smart case that was available for the iPad 2 with the kind of four-panel design? And I don't do a lot of case reviews, Scott, but I went out and I did some searching, so I can't really vouch for any of these alternatives. But because Apple has this huge accessory ecosystem around it, it was pretty easy to find some alternatives. So I'll tell you, the two of these brands are brand names that I've never heard of. They're a little bit cheaper cases in terms of the price. They come out of manufacturers out of Asia, so there's a lot of Asian products coming out into the marketplace. These ones that I found in particular have pretty good reviews on Amazon, so I feel pretty comfortable, and a lot of reviews. Of course, those things can be gamed, so again, take this with a grain of salt. The first one, though, I feel pretty good in recommending. It's the Case Crown Omni. Again, not a company I've heard of, Case Crown. It's $35 US, so very good price, but I found this one on iLounge's website, and it was actually the iPad Air case that had their highest rating. They gave it an A-, and it looks to me to be almost identical to the old four-panel Apple Smart case for the iPad 2. And it has the four-fold cover design, And I will have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to check it out. And if any of you have this case and can kind of vouch for it, let us know. Send me an email or an audio comment, and I can pass that along to Scott. The other two, as I mentioned, are pretty cheap cases. They're available on Amazon. The first one's called the Origami Slim Shell from Rue Case. It has a three-panel fold, but then it also has these additional creases and folds that allow it to go into more triangular-like shapes. It looks pretty cool, and it also looks like it'd be a lot more versatile than the smart cover option, so you could try that out. And that one's only $9.98 on Amazon, $9.98 US, so very, very cheap. And then the other one is called the Envelope, I-N-V-E-L-L-O-P, or from Envelope. It's called the Case Cover. It's $24.95 on Amazon. It's a leatherette design, so kind of a faux leather. It looked pretty nice, but it also has a four-fold cover and looks to be a lot more like Apple's original smart case. So you can take a look at all of those. Again, I'll have links in the show notes at maccast.com. But I thought I'd also throw it out to the community, because the main reason I don't do a lot of reviews on the MacCast is there's actually really two reasons. One is volume, just the sheer number of products out there on the market. I'm only one person. I don't have a big editorial staff that I can dole out reviews to. So it's very hard for me to do anything more than kind of prep the MacCast, the news and the tips and tricks and stuff like that. And then the other thing is just time. Because to me, especially for things like case reviews, but almost any product review, you really need to spend more than just a few minutes or even a few days with the product. I mean, you can form sort of a first impressions quick opinion, but in my experience, time shows that often something that you like, a product that you like immediately in the first week, can sometimes turn out to have issues or show flaws that you don't see originally, and then becomes maybe not something that you would pick. I've had this experience with a lot of cases where they seem great at first, but then fall apart weeks later. And, you know, I would really want to be able to review and put a product through its paces before I give it sort of the MacCast recommendation. And that's why I think the great thing for us to do is leverage the power of the MacCast community, especially when it comes to things like cases. So I'm just going to throw this idea out to you, and hopefully it'll start some conversations. I think we should use some of the community places, the MacCast Facebook page, the Google Plus community, or even better yet, the MacCast forum, to kind of start some threads maybe surrounding different kinds of cases and products and accessories for our Macs and our iOS devices. So let's maybe start some conversations with the best cases in various categories, things like maybe the best slim case, the best rugged case, the best stand-based case, the best keyboard case, which is something I'm particularly interested in. There are a lot of options out there on the market, and they all have their plus and minuses, but I'd rather hear those real-world, in-the-trenches kinds of reviews. And by that same token, I'm going to throw it out to you. You know, send in your reviews of your favorite cases, your favorite products, accessories, and things like that. I only ask that you keep them as brief as possible if you're doing an audio review, 3 minutes or less, and really stick to just highlighting out the standout features, the things that make that product work best for you, how it fits into your workflow, why you really like it, and why it's separated from maybe some of the other products that are in the rest of the pack. And I also welcome if you've had an experience where, like I said, you got a product, you thought it was really great at first, maybe you'd even had great reviews online or in some of the websites, but then later you found some flaws in that product. Let's talk about the sorts of things that maybe aren't so great, or you come to discover later, so that others can learn from that and maybe avoid some of these products, or at least find out if the manufacturer has improved or enhanced or updated a newer version of the product. And that way, I think we can have some of the best tried and true, really field-tested reviews of these products. So if you want to get involved with that, send your comments and emails along, maccast@gmail.com, or just pop into one of the MacCast communities and start sharing some of your thoughts and opinions, and we can all kind of help each other out in this end. And so hopefully some of you will have some great recommendations for Scott. Normally on the podcast, I like to keep things really Apple-focused, and we don't dive into things like Gmail too much, but Ben this week had an unusual and frustrating problem with Google or Gmail, Apple Mail and Apple support. And it's something that could have easily happened to any of us. So I actually wanted to share his story with you. What happened was he recently received an email from Apple saying that he had attempted to change his Apple ID information, but he actually hadn't. And then shortly after that, he received 13 verify your email address emails within the span of just about 10 minutes. And all of the emails were addressed to another person, even though they were coming in using his Gmail account. And these were emails from Apple about his Apple ID. So at first glance, you might think, well, you know, someone was trying to basically brute force attack or hack your account, Ben. I mean, right? That's what's going on. But Ben told me in his email that that was not what was happening. It was actually a more innocent kind of user error, but one that was causing him a lot of frustration and pain, and also exposing some of the personal information and details of this other user. And what triggered all of this was that the person who was updating their Apple ID was basically changing their contact email on their Apple ID account and using a Gmail address, and they decided to use a Gmail address that turned out to be Ben's without them really knowing it. And the reason they were able to do that, or probably more the reason this happened to them, is they didn't understand something that I didn't understand either until, Ben, you emailed me, and that is that Gmail does not recognize dots in an email address. So if you have the email janedoe@gmail.com, it is treated exactly the same as jane.doe@gmail.com, or even the same as j.a.n.e.d.o.e@gmail.com. All three of those emails, if you send that email, they will all go to janedoe@gmail.com. And so what this person had done is they had put in an email address with dots in it that was the same as Ben's Gmail account name. And so consequently, he was getting all of the notifications, but for this other woman. And it got worse when he started getting Apple Store receipts for her account. So she was buying apps or content on iTunes, and he started getting these emails, and he wanted them to stop. So needless to say, Ben contacted Apple for help, and that's when he did not get very good results. The first thing they suggested to him in Apple support, and I have to back up here a little bit, because I think Apple support, they try as best as they can, but it's still tech support, right? A lot of us expect Apple to do a little bit better or be a little bit better, but they are a huge company. They have a lot of people working for them, and usually the first tier support, they do the best they can, but they're just like any other kind of tech support, kind of working off scripts and maybe a little out of their gut and their prior experience and stuff like that. But he got to first tier support, and the first thing they suggested to him was that he simply change the email address on his account, his Apple ID, so that he stops getting these emails. And they suggested Yahoo or MSN, which that was the first really puzzling thing. And the point was, is that even wouldn't fix the issue, because these are emails that were going to his Gmail account, not to the account registered to his Apple ID. So that wouldn't have really solved anything. So odd suggestion, and just wouldn't really work. The second thing that they told him is, why not just spam filter those emails and ignore them? And that would work, but they'd still have mail going to the wrong address. That really wouldn't fix this woman's problem. And by setting up a filter, or maybe just marking those emails as spam, it could potentially start to false positive spam Ben's own emails. So that wasn't something that he really wanted to do. So Ben kept pressing the rep for a better solution. They went and talked to a supervisor, and then came back and said, well, this is really a Google issue, and suggested that Ben contact Gmail and tell them to stop recognizing addresses with dots in them as the same address and make them unique. Well, I don't think Ben's going to have much luck in getting Gmail to change their policies. So that really wasn't a suggestion. And luckily, Ben wasn't having any of that. And he kept pressing. And then finally, they just asked, well, why haven't you tried to email her directly and just tell her about the mistake? And that sounds like a good answer, probably the best answer they had given him. But Ben, as he pointed out, said it could look like a phishing email coming from me, and wouldn't it be better if Apple in an official email, contacted her and said, hey, you've put in the wrong email address. You probably want to go in and change it. And so what finally worked was Ben telling them, hey, I'm getting this woman's iTunes account purchases and her history and her email address, and this is actually a security issue. So at that point, the rep escalated it to the security team, who said they did deactivate her account and that she would be notified and required to change her information the next time she tried to log in. And so at that point, Ben really thought the ordeal was over, but then it got even stranger, because a bit later, Apple actually sent an email, the one to that dotted email address, which ended up going directly to Ben, because that's the source of the problem, right? But they were trying to contact this woman and explain that she needed to change her contact information. They also were emailing to say they had tried to reach her by phone, but kept getting voicemail. But the problem was, is the email that they thought they were sending to her that ended up in Ben's email box had additional information, like her phone number. So now Ben has her full name, her phone number, her prior email address, her mailing address, her buying habits, all those sorts of things. So stepping back a bit, I completely get that for you, Ben, this was completely a frustrating experience, a potential huge security risk to Gmail users. And the reality is, though, I think, as the Apple rep pointed out, this isn't exactly Apple's fault. It's really kind of nobody's fault. It's kind of this perfect storm of several good ideas in theory going horribly wrong in one specific scenario. And unfortunately, Ben, you were the target. I won't say victim, but you were the target of all of this messed up stuff, right? And that gets a little bit frustrating. And I can't imagine this is a new issue for Apple. And they probably should have some better policies in place for handling this, a better way to actually contact their customers to let them know they've just made a simple user mistake. But it does illustrate the point, and I wanted to point it out because this could happen to any of us. I mean, somebody just simply types in the wrong email address, and I've seen this happen before. I have this happen myself. I have a domain, and it's similar to this one company's domain, and employees of that one company often register stuff with that domain, and I get their emails all the time. There's really not much you can do about it other than try and contact that person directly and get them to fix the issue on their end. But Apple should kind of maybe have a better policy for sort of handling this stuff. But I want to move away from that, because there's actually some advantage if you're a Gmail user or a Google user to these kinds of aliases. Like I said, the feature that caused the trouble for Ben can actually be used in a useful way if you use Gmail. For example, using the dots in your own email addresses, you could kind of set up a filter for different kinds of emails. So for your business communication, maybe you send an email using an email address with the dots in it, and you use, for personal communication, one without the dots. Then you could set up mail rules in Apple's mail application to kind of filter and track those different addresses and handle stuff differently when you're automating your mail application. Another cool feature that Gmail has that I started using recently is something that they call automatic address aliases. So they don't have traditional mail aliases that you have to go in and set up and are sort of permanent. What they have is the ability to kind of create an on-the-fly alias using the plus symbol in your email address. So if you take your Gmail username and then put a plus after that, and then you can type anything in before the @gmail.com, and that creates this on-the-fly alias. So imagine Jane Doe plus spam @gmail.com. That address will still go, the result will still be sent to Jane Doe @gmail.com, so your standard Gmail account. This ends up being a great way to set up unique email addresses for various services that you might sign up for, so that you can better track and, again, filter and set up smart mailboxes and things like that for different kinds of services. So if you're getting a lot of Instagram notifications or Facebook notifications to your Gmail account, this would be a great way to filter it if you set up your contact address as Jane Doe plus Instagram.com for Instagram, you know, plus Instagram @gmail.com for Instagram, or Jane Doe plus Facebook @gmail.com for Facebook. And if you're doing a Maccast address, you might use Jane Doe plus Maccast @gmail.com. On and on and on. And you can set up as many of these as you want, and then you can filter all that incoming stuff based on that email address. I also like to do this because I want to track any services that might be giving or selling my email address to other places. So I know that if one of those goes out there and it doesn't, I get receive an email that doesn't come from that service, and I haven't said implicitly that they can share my email information, then I know that they're doing something nefarious and I can kind of catch them and call them on it. Luckily, I haven't had that experience happen to me yet, but I imagine it's coming someday, but at least I'll be able to track it using this trick. So I wanted to share that trick and information with you, and Ben, thank you for sending along that email. With that new Mac Pro hitting the street, if you're like me, you're like looking at that thing going, oh man, all that speed, all that power, maybe it's time for me to do a little update to my Mac. Can I afford a new model, or should I invest in some upgrades for my existing system? I've actually been pondering doing an SSD upgrade for my 2011 MacBook Pro. So many people have told me how much putting in an SSD has just rejuvenated their laptop. And I'm even thinking, because I never used my optical drive, of using OWC's data doubler method, where I move my spindle drive and put in a SSD and then move that over to where my optical drive was and take the optical drive out, maybe put that in a USB enclosure for those few times that I might need to access an optical disk. Like I said, I haven't probably used it in about 5 years, so I don't think that's going to be the case. And we've talked a lot about upgrades that you can do to your Mac here on the MacCast, some of the more typical things like RAM upgrades or SSD upgrades, and these things can add life to your aging system. But Vincent emailed me this week, and he was wondering about the merits of one of the lesser talked about upgrades.
Hi, Adam. This is Vincent from Los Angeles, and I am one of those fringe Mac users who actually use a Mac Pro as their main computer. I have a 2009 Mac Pro quad core that I love, and I would like to get at least another couple of years of use from this machine. At this point, I have pretty much maxed it out. RAM, SSD, USB 3, Blu-ray, graphics, you name it. But I'm wondering if I can still push it further. I have found many stories online of people who have successfully upgraded the CPU of a Mac Pro with much newer Intel processors. And you can even find places that will do it for you for a pretty penny. Would you recommend this upgrade? Or is this even worth it? Or are the rest of the components already too dated? I don't like the form factor of the new Mac Pro. Plus, I believe I will have to spend an arm and a leg in order to get something comparable to what I already have. I hope this topic is not too geeky and you can give me some advice. Thank you for all your time that you put in the show. I have been a listener for many years, and I hope there are many more to come. Keep up the great work.
Hey, thanks, Vincent. I will continue to do the shows, I think, as long as anyone's willing to listen to me. That seems like it's going to be for a really long time, so that's a good thing. But I appreciate your question, and I totally get where you're coming from, because for something like Mac Pro, you know, you really lay out a large initial investment, and then over time you load it up with all of these enhancements and features. So it sounds like you said, you put in an SSD, you've maxed out the RAM, you've added Blu-ray, all those things. Maybe you've added extra PCI cards, more internal drives, storage, and you're looking at that new Mac Pro. And when you start pricing out what it's going to take to get the new Mac Pro to kind of come up, at least in terms of the add-ons and accessories, to the level of your current machine, you're looking at a pretty good outlay. A lot of people are actually also wondering, just in general, how am I going to migrate from this big tower, this old Mac Pro? I've got three drives in there. I've got all this, you know, these full height PCI cards. How am I going to squeeze that or get that into this new Mac Pro model, depending upon, you know, sort of what sorts of enhancements you have in there? And you start pricing that out, and that is not, like you said, it's not going to be cheap. So the first thing I want to talk about is just a general tip for anybody who might be looking to move from a Mac Pro tower to one of the new mini Mac Pros, who wants to take their hard drives and their PCIe cards with them. You can actually do that. There's a couple of products from Sonnet Technologies that will basically allow you to migrate all that stuff to your new system. But as you pointed out, that's not cheap. So you start with the cost of the new Mac Pro. Minimum, you're looking at $3,000 US for the base model. And then Sonnet makes the Sonnet's Echo Express 3. They have a desktop version and a rack-mounted version. You probably want to go with the rack-mounted version if you're going to be moving hard drives, because it has a little drive kit adapter that you can get, so you can put everything into sort of one unit. And what they have in that Express 3 is it has three full-height PCIe slots that you can throw your full-height PCIe cards from your old Mac Pro into. And then it hooks up via Thunderbolt, and it has all the ports and things like that you're going to need. Well, that's another $1,200, $1,199 US. And then you need to get a SATA Pro PCIe card to connect the drive kit to so that you can hook up your three hard drives. I think that actually has four SATA connectors on it, and it's designed, you know, to be, you can put it into your Mac Pro and have it connect externally, but in the Sonnet's Echo Express, I think you put it on the inside and then you connect everything internally through this little drive kit adapter. So you buy that card, that's $299.95 US, and then you need the little drive kit, which is going to give you power and connectors and all the stuff to fit into the Sonnet Echo Express and slot in your three and a half inch SATA hard drives, and that's another $99. So you add all that up, and your minimum cost is going to be about $4,600 US to migrate everything from your old Mac Pro to a new Mac Pro, kind of as is. Now, not everybody's going to need to do that, so you'll have to adjust things accordingly, but that kind of illustrates, I think, the point that you're making is, do I move to a new Mac Pro and spend all this money to kind of bring everything along with me, or do I maybe just take what I have and get an upgraded CPU and maybe give it a little bit more life? And actually, I had this conversation with Jim Tanis over at Tech Review, techreview.com, and he actually upgraded his 2006 iMac, believe it or not, with a new Intel Core 2 Duo CPU. So a lot of people don't know that you can actually upgrade the CPUs in a lot of different models of Mac and kind of bring new processor technology to your Mac. Now, the upgrade process in desktop Macs is fairly straightforward because many of the models, iMacs, Mac Minis even, and like you know with your Mac Pro, they have socketed CPUs. So you can go buy a new Intel-compatible Intel processor, and that's part of the struggle with doing this kind of upgrade, but a compatible processor, and you can pop the old one out and pop the new one in. And that sounds really easy, like pop it out, pop it in. It's not quite that simple. But if you're willing to do a little work and kind of do a little research and things like that and get your hands dirty, it can be done. Getting at the CPU can be tricky, though. Luckily, we have iFixit. They have great teardowns, and they kind of can walk you through the process. But you're going to have to wade through the upgrade websites and the forums, and you're going to have to find the right CPU that's going to support your system, and there's really specific models and things like that. You need to pay attention to things like cooling requirements and how much heat is it going to generate. In some cases, in order to get a more modern processor, you might have to also upgrade things like your fans and cooling system, which can add more complexity to the upgrade process. But if you want, you can stuff faster CPUs into many Mac models. You're also going to need to learn about thermal paste and how to apply that properly, and that can be a little bit tricky. So it's not an upgrade that's for the faint of heart, but it certainly can be done. And even if you do all that stuff, even if you go through all that process, you're still going to have some challenges, because in order to get an older system to recognize that new CPU, you're probably going to have to find a firmware. There's firmware available online, but you're probably going to have to upgrade your firmware so that it recognizes the new processor. And even once you have the processor in there and it's recognized, you're still going to have some limits that you wouldn't have with a new system. You're still going to be limited by the general system architecture. So the bus speed of the entire system is going to be limited. You may be limited by the maximum amount of RAM that you can put in. You're at the very least could be limited by the number of physical slots, but also just the speed of the memory and RAM. So you're not going to get the latest and greatest performance just by having even an upgraded processor. And you're also now sort of running this odd, never built by Apple, unsupported system. And there shouldn't really be any issues. Any software that would run on those processors should pretty much run in your system. But if you do run into issues, you're not going to really have any recourse. You have a weird configuration. You have something that nobody's ever tested against because it's never been really out there in the wild. So you could have end up having these little finicky problems that you have to kind of troubleshoot and work through on your own. So getting back to your main question, you know, is it worth it? It's really hard to say. And, you know, it's going to be a result of how much you're willing to get in and fiddle and learn and tweak things. But overall, I think what you're adding, if you're upgrading your processor, because you're not going to be able to jump all the way to the latest and greatest, you're kind of going to be somewhere in the middle. You're probably going to get a year or two of extra life out of your aging system. I actually did a processor upgrade on my blue and white G3. There were these great G4 upgrades, and it was great. I was able to upgrade the processor, and I got another year or two of life out of it. And looking at some of the research around some of these CPU upgrades, I'm just totally generalizing on here, but most of the benchmarking, and again, it's going to depend on the processor you buy and how high, you know, how much you can jump up. But in general, I'm seeing older systems with upgraded CPUs getting about a 20 to maybe on the a high end 50% bump in various benchmarks in performance. And again, that's benchmark. That's not real world performance. That's going to be somewhere usually a little bit lower than what you would see just in benchmark testing. And the other thing is, for you, single CPUs, depending on the model that you're choosing, they can be hard to find because a lot of those processors just aren't made anymore, the ones that are going to be compatible with your older system. You can find them on eBay used, probably about the $200 range for each processor. If you have multiple processors, that adds more complexity and more cost. So you could be looking at spending $200, $400, which seems like a good upgrade. And that maybe will give you another, like I said, year or life out of your Mac. So I think if you're adventurous, if you're a modder type and you just really want a project that's pretty cool, upgrading your CPU is a cool thing to tell your friends and family about. And, you know, if you're willing to go for it and dive in and get dirty and down and dirty, then you could end up with a faster system. Otherwise, you know, personally, I would say save that $200 or whatever and save all the time and effort you would have to put into actually figuring this out. Eke by with what you have until you can actually afford to just flat out buy a new system and make the migration. So I really think it's going to be a personal choice and really depend on the type of person you are. But overall, I would say for the majority of people, it's probably not worth messing with a CPU upgrade. There's just sort of these fringe cases, and you might fall into that group where I think it might be beneficial. So I'm sorry if that doesn't directly answer your question, but hopefully it gives you some ideas and some things to think about to help you kind of come to your own conclusion and your own decision. And I'd love to hear what you decide to do and how the process goes, especially if you go through the upgrade process. And I'd love to hear from you if you think it was worth it, if you go for it. So please follow up with us if you do. But with that is going to do it for the MacCast for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show's sponsors: Smile, makers of Texas Banner, PDF Pen, Disclable, also PDF Pen for iPhone or iPad, Texas Banner Touch, and the new PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can check out all their software, get more information and details over at smilesoftware.com. Drobo, you can get 10% off any Drobo right now by using the coupon code MC10 during checkout at drobostore.com. Transporter by Connected Data, you can get all the benefits of cloud storage with the control and security and privacy of a physical hard drive or NAS. You can get 10% off your own Transporter by using the coupon code MACCAST. And also right now until the end of the year, you can get $30 off a 1 terabyte Transporter by using the code MC30. That's MC30 at the Transporter store. Just go over to filetransporter.com/MACCAST to get all the details and save on your own Transporter. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets online. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth over at gazelle.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. A big thank you to you for your support, for listening, for staying subscribed. I really, truly appreciate you being a member of the MacCast community. Really, without you, there would not be a show. So thank you very much for everything that you do to make this whole thing happen. If you have any feedback for me, you have a comment, you have a question, please send your emails, your audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. Also, be sure to check out the MacCast website. There you'll find show notes with everything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast. And while there, check out the MacCast forum, forum.maccast.com, and let's start sharing some of our recommendations and suggestions for some of the better Apple and Mac accessories out there. I'll try and maybe pop back into the forum and set up some of those threads and categories, and maybe we can start filling that out. I'll try and do that before the end of the year. And if I don't, I'm sure you'll email me to remind me to set that up. You can also have some of those conversations on our social media networks. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. I try to respond to my tweets as quickly and as frequently as I possibly can. Also, be sure to check out the MacCast Facebook page at facebook.com/TheMacCast, and check out the Google Plus community. Just search for MacCast on Google Plus. I'm hoping someday that they will actually give me a short URL so I can tell you how to get there. But easiest way, just search MacCast Google Plus on Google, and you should find that community there. So I look forward to seeing you those places online. But until next time, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, Happy Festivus, Happy Holidays, and I will talk to you all again real soon.